Welcome, everyone, to episode 133 of the NBA podcast. The Western Conference semifinals are set, so today we are going to preview both matchups, the Warriors-Pelicans and the Rockets-Jazz. Before we get underway, I wanted to remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted now on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, so check them out on Twitter, at AlmightyCasts. Joining me today, as always, is my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
It's going well, Brian. We have a lot of content to push out today.
We sure do. Yeah, we're going to do the semifinals preview today, and then we are going to bring back our beloved Ba Felicia segment tomorrow, where we discuss the four teams who got knocked out in the first round of the playoffs, namely the Oklahoma City Thunder, Portland Trail Blazers, Minnesota Timberwolves, and San Antonio Spurs. So stay glued to our Twitter feed. You're going to have a lot of great content coming out in the next couple days. But let's start, Mort, with Warriors-Pelicans. I mean, I think we all expected the Warriors to be on this side, especially after they drew the Spurs, the injury-ravaged Spurs. The Pelicans, probably the biggest surprise in the first round, just by virtue, I mean, I wanted to pick them, but I didn't because I'm a coward, but by virtue of sweeping the Blazers, I don't think anyone reasonably expected that. So,
oh, no.
I mean, we got to start with Stephen Curry, just because that's a big story for the Warriors. He is questionable for Game 1. We don't know whether he's going to play or not. They will update that at some point later today. But, Mort, when he does return, what do you expect from him right away? Do you think he's going to be either at or near 100%, or do you think he's going to be a little bit rusty after this layoff?
Well, a little bit rusty, but I mean, a little bit rusty for Stephen Curry is still better than 85% of the rest of the league.
Right.
So
I think that's even low.
That might even be low. So my answer to that question really is, does it matter? In that sense. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, he'll still be a shooting threat. He'll still come in and you'll have to key your entire defense around him. I mean, look, Stephen Curry at just 50%, you need to be worried about all the time, and I feel like the time off would be good for his legs. It would be good for him to come back and not really feel like the burden of his legs and feet or whatever, because if he had been playing the entire first round or the late season regular games, you probably would have been a little bit tired and fatigued, and you know, maybe he takes a couple of games to get accustomed to being back, but I'll rather have that trade-off than I would have a tired Stephen Curry walking out there.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think it is going to be a trade-off between, you're right, he's not going to have, he'll have fresh legs, but I think that the day after that first game, he's going to be pretty damn sore. Joel Embiid had the same problem when he came back a couple weeks ago. He said, you know, he had a 3-week layoff instead of 6, but he said he woke up that next morning and his entire body hurt. So I think Steph is going to have that as well. But we also, I mean, it was only a couple of years ago that Steph missed some games in the playoffs, came back. He was fine. I mean, he looked good right away, but he never was the full, like, 100% version of himself really throughout that entire rest of the playoffs. And, you know, Warriors fans often point to that as part of the reason they ended up blowing that 3-1 lead against Cleveland, is because it was like, you got 90 to 95% Steph instead of 100%. So
That's interesting, though. Like, that's fair, because what that series was decided in total by 4 points, if I'm not mistaken. Like, I think the Cavs outscored Golden State by 4 points in a 7-game series. Mm-hmm. So being an additional 5 to 10% better, that would probably have made the difference. So fair call, Dubs fans.
So I'm interested to see how he looks. I mean, you're right. He's going to be a shooting threat no matter what, and just having him on the floor will help Golden State's spacing. But I am interested to see whether he is full strength Steph or just, you know, needs a couple games to shake off the rust. It may not matter because, you know, the Pelicans, to their credit, did a hell of a job shutting down Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum in the first round against the Blazers. Steph and Klay are, they level up. This is like, you know, when you're in a video game, you just went to the next boss battle. This is this is the frankly, for the Pelicans, probably their final boss battle. So how do you expect that matchup to play out, Mort?
Well, I expect Drew Holiday to keep going at everyone, essentially, as aggressively as he did in the first round. And I do think that Steph being, you know, not 100% is going to have Drew smell some blood. Yeah. I definitely think he's going to be keyed in on Steph immediately. And it will be interesting to see, because let's be honest for a second. Damian Lillard is kind of like Steph. He's not as dynamic, but like he takes a lot of the similar shots, like coming off a screen at 30 feet away from the basket. Like, that's a pull-up.
Right.
That's the same with Steph. Their playing style is somewhat similar. And Drew just found a way constantly to be in Dame's space. Like, he would just take away the right hand on drives so he couldn't get to his floater. He would continuously rotate at the appropriate time. He would pick him up in weird angles and just make life hell on his shooting angles.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that sort of be the same thing with Steph. And here's the kicker. And here's what makes it interesting. Klay Thompson, as an on-ball creator, is not as good as CJ McCollum as an on-ball creator. We saw CJ take on more of an offensive role in terms of creating his own shot, because that was necessary. That was out of necessity. And to his credit, like, CJ had a decent series. He shot 52% from the field overall, 42 from three, 25.3 points a game. Like, that's not a bad offensive output.
Mm-hmm.
So you had he was able to step up as that secondary scorer who could create. Can Klay do that consistently? Like, I know that he's gotten better. He has, as an all-ball, on-ball guy. But he's not on the level of McCollum in that department. But as a standstill shooter, he's like 3,000 dimensions better. So you have to gauge, what do you want to do? Do you want to force the ball into Klay's hands a lot more by taking it away from Steph?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's probably doable, but the Dubs have one thing that Portland certainly don't. They have a Kevin Durant that you can then pass the ball to. Or a Draymond Green who can set up the offense, right?
Yeah.
So there are some outlets there that's just going to make it a lot more difficult. I'm just expecting Drew to keeping Steph not in check, because nobody keeps Steph in check, but I think he's able to maybe turn it into a zero sum. Like, the output that Drew has offensively and defensively, Mike, and with the fact that Steph is not 100%, they might actually cancel each other out. That's like the best case scenario for that matchup, by the way. But
yeah,
if he does that, that's pretty positive, right?
I mean, if you're the Pelicans, until Steph shows that he is full strength, I don't even know that you necessarily put Drew on him. I think you put Rondo on him, because here's the thing about this matchup compared to the Blazers matchup. Mm. The Blazers, Lillard's listed at 6'3", McCollum's listed at 6'3". So for the Pelicans, Rondo's 6'1", Drew Holiday 6'4", Etuan Moore 6'4". They match up pretty well size-wise with those guys.
Yeah.
Now you go to the Warriors. Steph is 6'3", Klay is 6'7".
Yeah.
And then you got KD, who is, you know, listed at 6'9". Yeah, listed at 6'9", but he's actually 7 feet. So you need bigger bodies to throw at those guys, whereas, you know, the Blazers' backcourt's a little bit smaller, so the Pelicans' lack of wing size is less of an issue. Now, I'm not saying Drew Holiday is not going to get some possessions on Steph. I think with all of these guys, you know, there's going to be a primary cover, but you're going to see, you know, Drew will take some possessions on Curry for sure, especially if they switch on to him. But, I mean, I think that's going to be one of the really the keys to this series, is the Warriors have the size to really give the Pelicans trouble. And as you said, Mort, you know, the Warriors have a Kevin Durant, and like, the Pelicans were starting a 6'4 Etuan Moore as their starting small forward in that first series. Like, who do they have against Kevin Durant? Or do they have anyone?
They'll probably go Mirotic. Not that that'll end well, but like, Nico has some length. And like, he's not a total slouch defensively. I don't know why he's ever gotten that reputation. That's wrong. I mean, Lord knows I've followed the guy for a long while. I mean, look, I followed this guy religiously when he was at Real Madrid, when the Bulls had his draft rights for three seasons. This dude can be a difference maker defensively. The thing is, he's just more of an offensive-oriented player. But when he puts his focus on defensively, I mean, he's good. He's not cancel-out Kevin Durant good, but mm-hmm. he can make it a fight. But going back just briefly to the Drew thing, do you feel at all it would be kind of a disservice not to put Drew on a primary ball handler? Because I feel his defense is strong enough to be able to kind of limit ball handlers, whereas if you put him on Clay, I sort of feel you waste some of that defensive flexibility that he has. I kind of want the best defense out of Drew, and I think you get that on a ball handler, like the more impactful defense.
But then you're putting a 6'1 Rondo on a 6'7 Clay?
I'll live with it, though, because he's primarily a spot-up shooter, right? Rondo is long-armed as well. Yeah, like,
it's not going to make up for a 6-inch height discrepancy.
No. Obviously, I mean, it's a clear disadvantage. I'm just looking at the layers of it, and I would just... If I'm sitting there and I'm seeing Drew, who is the most versatile perimeter defender, you know, on mm-hmm. the Pelicans, I would kind of feel that he did not... Not that he did not put the effort in, because obviously he will, but mm-hmm. I would feel I wouldn't get the most out of it if I placed him on a guy who primarily spots up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point, and I think that's going to be one of the tough decisions for Alvin Gentry, along with, you know, just really just how do you cope with their size at every position? Mm. Most notably the backcourt and with KD. I mean, obviously Anthony Davis is a little bit... I mean, he's a mismatch problem of his own, which right. we'll hit on in a minute, but... Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. And, like, you know, I expect Solomon Hill to get some time off the bench on the KD assignment. Ian Clark, you know, he's going to get some time too. But they really, I mean, we've said for a while now that the Pelicans have one of the worst wing rotations in the NBA. Mm. This is the matchup where it's going to come to bite them in the ass.
Yeah. No, you're right. Then, I mean, then you could maybe make up for it a little bit. Because you have AD, who's probably mm-hmm. going to guard JaVale. That's not a big threat. Like, or even if he guards Draymond. I mean, Draymond is not a high-volume scorer.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can sort of hide Davis in use him primarily as a help defender around the mm-hmm. basket, and he can take possessions off defensively because he's guarding not that important players,
right?
Then you can assert him even more offensively, to maybe tip the scales just a little bit. I mean, he came in averaging. I don't have the stats pulled up, but didn't he average like 33 points in the first round series against
Portland? 33 points and 12 rebounds. Yeah,
right, which is ridiculous. But that's an aside. He would need to do similarly against Golden State. Yeah, and look, as much as I love Draymond, and as much as I think JaVale is a hidden gem, those two guys probably cannot contain Davis. And if you rest his legs and just go tell Davis, get 40, just go get 40. I don't care if you, mm-hmm. you know, if you take possessions off defensively, just go get 40.
Yeah.
I mean, then that might be the way to do it. Looking at the matchups, I don't think defense is going to be the primary weapon for the Pelicans anyway. Not this year. They need to outgun them, honestly, which is never a good plan against the Dubs, but I think that's their own strategy. And you just mentioned Ian Clark. Mm-hmm. I find that addition by the Pelicans pretty timely mm-hmm. because he was there just last year. Oh, hey guys, look what I can tell you about these Dubs.
right. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think it is going to just basically be the Warriors are going to get their points and the Pelicans have to match, but... You know, look at that first round production.
Mm.
They had 33 from Brow. They had almost 28 from Drew. Nico had 18. Rondo had 11, 13 assists, 7.5 rebounds. Those are their only four scorers in double figures. Each one was fifth with 7.5. So I think you're right, Mort. Like, they're going to need more. You know, they're big four, if you want to call them that. All played very well against the Blazers and helped fuel that upset, but they're going to need more from guys like Etuan Moore, Ian Clark, Darius Miller, Solomon Hill. Like, if they don't get that, this is going to be a very quick series.
Yep.
So, before we move on, what's your prediction for this series?
Dubs in... six? I want to give... Oh. I don't... Yeah. I don't think New Orleans is just going to sweep the Blazers. The Blazers are a good team. Like, I don't think they just run through the Blazers and don't put up a fight against Golden State.
Yeah.
Six games.
Yeah. I'm going Dubs in five. The fact, I mean, I'm assuming Steph plays, if not in game one, I'm assuming he plays game two. Because the NBA, I don't want to say they rigged the schedule, because that's not true at all. Like, this schedule is very advantageous for the Warriors. They have a game Saturday. I think game two is Tuesday, and then game three is Friday. So they get 2 days off between games one and two, and 2 days off between games two and three. So even if Steph misses game one, he gets another 3 days to recover. And then, like, you know, he gets more time than usual to get back into the swing of things, which I think is going to help them a lot. And, you know, the Warriors did not play all that well against the Spurs. Like, it was probably a C effort because they knew they could get away with it. I think they're going to respect the Pelicans a lot more than they respected the Spurs. And I think we're going to see a much more focused Warriors team.
So. See, I'm not so sure about that. I think the Warriors are just arrogant enough to not realize what the Pelicans just did.
That's very possible, but I don't know. With Steph back, they're just a completely different team. So
that is true.
So yeah,
but Brow is still Brow. That's why I'm saying true. Six. I mean,
I know, dude. It's fair. The KD thing, I have no idea how they stop. If they slow him down, you very well could be right. But I don't know. I could see them limiting the backcourt a little bit. I don't know how they stop KD. He's going to feast. So,
yep.
All right, Mort, let's flip to the other side of the Western Conference bracket, which just got solidified last night. The Utah Jazz finished off the OKC Thunder, solidifying their matchup with the Houston Rockets, who KO'd the Minnesota Timberwolves in five. So, Mort, this one, again, it's much like Warriors-Pelicans. There are some serious mismatches on both sides of this series, I would say. The first issue for Utah is Ricky Rubio. He strained his hamstring early in Game 6 against the Thunder, was immediately ruled out for the rest of the game, which does not seem to bode well for his availability for Game 1. We don't know when he's supposed to get an MRI at some point today. Don't believe, at least as of yet, the Jazz have announced anything, but I'm assuming he's going to miss at least game one, if not more time. So how big is his absence going to be?
It's going to be pretty big because he's always been a defensive asset and he's always been a playmaker. This year, he's begun shooting the three ball at a higher clip. Losing that is pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually looking at some stats recently and only Donovan Mitchell and Ricky Rubio were unassisted on less than 50%. Like everyone else were assisted on more than 50% of their made field goals.
Wow.
So that means that the entire Utah Jazz team is much reliant on being set up. Mm-hmm. Whereas Mitchell and Rubio are the two guys who can, Mitchell more so than Rubio, obviously, can create their own offense in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
If you take Rubio away, that leaves Mitchell.
Yeah.
And that's just Mitchell. Everyone else needs to be set up at a much higher rate. Mm-hmm. Like, fair, you can give the ball to Joe Ingles a little bit more.
Yep.
He's a fine playmaker. He's a wonderful passer. But I don't think he mimics the lack of Rubio to the same extent. He can't mimic Rubio.
Yeah.
Like, he was a perfect complementary passer to Rubio. Like, he was the guy who, if there was a term, like, secondary playmaker in that term, like, that would be him. He was a guy who could set everyone up as the secondary option. You take that away, who does that become now? Like Donovan Mitchell? And
yeah,
that's fine in a like, but you need him to score. You need him to be the shooter.
Right.
Like he took 24 shots a game against OKC out of damn near necessity.
Right. I mean, you're probably going to get to see a little bit more Dante Exum. Alec Burks got dusted off after the Rubio injury, so I would expect more of him too. But yeah, I mean, that's what, when Rubio got hurt, they gave it to Ingles, and they said, you're now our pick and roll playmaker, make something happen. And then, you know, Donovan Mitchell also was just incredible, especially with his finishes around the basket. But
oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
I'm with you. I mean, it's, you know, when you're going up against Chris Paul and James Harden, that's a, like, Rubio's a pretty good defensive player. That's a huge pro that could have, you know, CP3 and Harden, we're always going to have the advantage over Rubio and Mitchell, but that swings even the pendulum even more in favor of Houston. So hopefully Rubio will get back quickly and, you know, that make this a competitive series, but I feel like without him, the Jazz are in some serious trouble.
Oh, they are. I mean, there's no question. I do think that it'll take a game.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Donovan Mitchell, I'm sorry, he's just too damn good.
Yeah, I agree.
And I just, can I just say something real quick about Mitchell here? This was kind of what I was been alluding to the entire season when I went back and forth in regards to the rookie race, because I was always talking about his impact. Like, what, you know, in Rookie of the Year conversations, we always get bogged down on statistics. Mm-hmm. Whereas I was looking at, look at the value he presents Utah. Like, this first round just proves what I was trying to say. Like, he's invaluable to this Utah Jazz offense. We like, remove Mitchell from the equation. Oh my God, that would be the worst shit show I've ever seen.
Right, like, they can't score without him.
No.
Often. Like, I mean,
at all.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, there when he struggled toward the end of game five, that's that plus... Rudy Gobert getting in foul trouble, that allowed the Thunder to come back from that massive 25-point deficit. And, you know, again in Game 6 toward the end, the Thunder sliced down a double-digit lead, tied the game toward the end of it, and then, you know, Mitchell really hit... I mean, God, that third quarter last night, what, he had, like, 22 points?
22 points. Made 10 straight shots, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was going, like, shot for shot with Russ. Russ was equally ridiculous on the other end, and, you know, Russ was basically doing... Well, I know. We'll talk about Russ in a little bit.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, Russ was doing what he was doing in Game 5, but in Game 6, Mitchell went, you know, shot for shot with him and really kept the Jazz alive. So that goes into my next question, Mort. I think the Thunder series, that's where you really felt Andre Roberson, his absence.
Oh,
like, if they had Roberson... with all due respect to Mitchell, he would not have, you know, maybe he would have gotten his 28 points, but he would have been far less efficient from the field.
Oh, absolutely. Like, so, Mitchell had a true shooting percentage of 55.5, like, this series. That is just barely above league average. But, again, rookie, first time in the playoffs, like, with Andre Roberson there, you could probably shave 10% off of that. Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
So now Houston, I feel like, has the guys, you know, I don't know that... if I'm Mike D'Antoni, I'm not putting James Harden on Donovan Mitchell. Maybe you do Chris Paul, but then you've also got a bunch of wings in Trevor Ariza, PJ Tucker. We don't know about Luke Mbamute's status, I believe, but you have to assume he might be back at some point this series.
So he's more of a pseudo big, though, right?
Yeah.
He's turned into more of a pseudo big.
But, like, they have the wing slash forward depth to really... complicate Mitchell's life that OKC did not have. So who do you think draws the primary assignment, or do you think it's really just like a full rotation of guys?
Oh, full rotation. Look, CP3 is a good defender, but I'm going to say this confidently because of Mitchell's size and because of his youth and because of his scoring prowess. Mitchell would eat Chris Paul alive. Look at that. Look at that size.
Yeah.
Look at the strength. What on earth could CP3 do against Mitchell? Like, the wingspan, I don't even know what Mitchell's looks at as his weight. Probably 211. He's probably more 225, if anything. Like, he's a bulldog.
Yeah.
Like, how does a 6 foot, 185 Chris Paul stop that?
Right.
Answer is you don't. Really.
I think the answer is Clint Capella is the one who stops it when you get close to the rim.
But that goes into your second option. Like, that's a design.
Right.
Like, on an island, forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. I think it wouldn't surprise me to see Ariza get the assignment in the starting lineup, but I'm totally with you that they're going to just rotate. That's what you need to do with all of these star scorers. That's been the way to, you know, solve LeBron James in the playoffs for a long time. You need to throw a full cavalry of guys so they don't know what to expect on any given possession. Like, the more you can sow confusion, the better. But if you're, you know, if you just have Like, with all due respect to Roberson, they would, I think OKC would have just put Roberson on Mitchell the entire series, and I think Roberson would have handled that well. But short of like a first team all defensive wing, this is what you do. You throw a bunch of different guys at him, really try to muck it up. And, you know, I think, as I alluded to earlier, I think part of their design will be, all right, if he does use his strength to overpower a Chris Paul or a James Harden, well, we have a Clint Capella. You know, he's not Rudy Gobert, but he's still a good defensive presence in the middle of our back or front court. So I think it'll be a team effort to guard Mitchell, but, you know, if as you said earlier, Mort, if Mitchell isn't going, I don't know who else Utah has to really, like, favors is going to, he'll play well, I think. But, yeah. You know, it's, they don't have the firepower to keep up with Houston if Mitchell is struggling.
No. And you need more out of Jay Crowder than his,
yeah.
Let me look that up, 45% true shooting percentage. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That was just abysmal. Right. No, I mean, I will say this, though. This is the perfect test for Houston, though, isn't it? Like, yeah. You're matched up against the league's best defense.
Yep.
So you know that you're in for a dogfight when you're on offense because you're up against Utah. They're going to go through this series. They're going to come out of the other end because they're just too talented not to.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you meet Golden State in the Western Conference Finals, you're looking at them and you're going, we just went through Utah's defense. Right. We can go through you too because we have the offense as well. Like, we can do that.
Yeah, so that
I
actually,
think that has to be the big thing. Yeah,
that leads to my next question, because I think in some ways for Utah, OKC was a great matchup, especially without Roberson, because you can kind of goad Russ into so many mid-range shots, and like you know, a lot of his strength is driving to the basket. You want him shooting three pointers as he did toward the end of Game 6, and just airballed a couple of them. Like throughout the whole series with Rudy Gobert in the middle of the paint, when they went to the rim, their field goal percentage went down significantly. Houston, meanwhile, you know, we talked about it in the Minnesota series, they're number one in 3 points made and attempted throughout the regular season. They, under Daryl Morey, they have largely eschewed that mid-range game. With Chris Paul in the fold, you know, they've incorporated a little bit more, but it seems like Houston's style of offense, do you think that's going to negate some of Rudy Gobert's impact defensively?
Well, the more threes that you take, it's just less chances for Gobert to contest those shots.
Right.
So that's definitely going to play a big factor. The thing is, I mean, you still need to get good looks.
Yeah.
There's a big misconception about Houston, and I see this frequently. People assume that Houston just jack up 3-point shots with no planning.
Right.
That's not how it is. They don't just take, you know, contested 3-pointers. If the 3 isn't there, they move the ball.
Yeah.
I mean, and if that means that they have to make a drive or even enter it into the post, which we have seen on occasion, that's what they do. They've gotten smarter in terms of their shot selection. They are no longer turning down free shots. You know, and I think that was the big problem with Golden State in 3-4 years ago. Like, they were so keyed in on the 3-point shot, and then when KD arrived, a little bit before that actually, it was more like, let's just take the open shot, whatever is given, because they didn't really develop Draymond into becoming like a legitimate 3-point threat.
Mm-hmm.
So when they had him, you know, open at 16, it was like, shoot it.
Right.
They just didn't. They realized it would be foolish of us to turn down free and open shots, regardless of where they're at. If they're at 16 feet, take it. If it's a three, take it. If it's a layup, take it. And I think Houston has grown a little bit more comfortable in taking those mid-range shots, basically out of necessity mostly, but adding Chris Paul, who will always take them and can hit them at a high rate, I think it opened up a little bit. I think Houston has matured in a way where they look at it and go, you know what, this is a tight playoff series. We cannot afford to just go three or die. Like, that's not a mentality we can use. So if that means an open mid-ranger, let's take it. So that approach, I think, is going to be the key aspect here. obviously they're going to do everything in their power to avoid Gobert. Mm-hmm. I think that would just be smart. I mean, Clint Capella cannot create his own offense in the posts to, at least not against Gobert,
right,
where he will be a major offensive asset. So we'll see. James Harden, I still feel, can get away on a few drives here or there because he's so crafty.
Yep. And he's also going to try to draw, like, that's your best offense against Utah is drawing fouls on Gobert.
Yep. It is. I mean, absolutely. We'll see. I mean, it really depends on how the ball swings. It also depends on how Utah rotates out on the perimeter. I mean, we go back on this all the time. Like, the best, and we can thank Seth Partnow for this one because he's right, the best three-point defense is not allowing the shot.
Right.
It's not, like, just get a hand up. Obviously,
yeah,
like, you need to, if the shot is attempted, then you need to contest it. But that isn't the main problem. The problem is allowing them. So you need to not allow those open threes. If Utah can do that, then you'll be forced to find an alternative means.
Yeah. And I mean, part of the issue, like for Houston in that first round series against Minnesota, they took 88 shots per game overall. 43.4 of those were three-pointers. So almost half of their field goal attempts were from three. The second closest team, the second highest team in terms of threes is Cleveland. Heading into game seven, at least, they have 33 attempts per game. So Houston took 10 more three-point attempts than any other team in the playoffs in the first round. They shot only 34.6%, though.
Mm-hmm.
So Harden shot pretty well, 38.5. Ariza was okay at 35. CP3 was below 30%. Eric Gordon was 30.2%. Gerald Green was 30.8%. Like, they need those guys to actually hit those shots, or this three-point heavy approach is not going to fare well. I mean, they were at 36.2% during the regular season. So, you know, almost 2 percentage points higher during the regular season. Now,
which matters when you're on that kind of volume.
Right, right. So does Utah have, as you said, do they have the personnel to not allow so many open threes? I think so. I mean, they've got a lot of length in that starting lineup. It's just going to be really interesting to see how both sides match up in terms of offensive and defensive approach, because I think a lot of Houston's offensive advantages will help negate Gobert and some of Utah's defensive strengths. Whereas, you know, Utah, it really just comes down to Ricky Rubio, man. So
yeah,
let's assume he misses at least games one and two. I think that's probably, you know, probably the best case scenario that Utah can hope for at this point. I hope I'm wrong, but he's had hamstring issues already this year. He got ruled out so quickly that, you know, doesn't seem to bode well for his short-term availability. So assuming he misses games one and two, what's your prediction for the series, Mort?
Oh, man. If he misses games one and two, it's probably going to be a slaughter in the first two games. And I think that's going to carry some momentum. I also think after the first two games, Houston's going to be keyed in on Golden State. Yeah. And that's when they flip that switch going, we don't care if it's, like, theoretically, if it's the Charlotte Hornets in front of us or the Phoenix Suns, we are going to murder every team in front of us, and we're going to play like our A++ game from here on out and onwards.
Yeah.
So I think if they get the first two games if Rubio's not there, they will get them. Then I just think they smell blood to a degree where they just go supernova to prepare themselves for Golden State, because that's the big test.
Yeah.
And if that happens, sweep, probably. Oof.
Yeah.
But losing Rubio is just such a, it's just a punch in the gut. I think he's going to will his way back some way. And I think that's going to be enough. I still hope that Utah takes at least a game.
Yeah.
Just to make it a series. I think this is a good one. I mean, and also this would kind of help Houston a little bit. If they lose just one game against Utah here, they will have to they'll have one more game against a top-notch defense that I think they will learn a lot from. I mean, it's almost like I hope that this series is extended for the sake of Houston, so they can just find so many different ways against an elite defense to go, okay, we learned this from this game. We know we can do this now. Like, that's a lot of data and a lot of knowledge you can take on to the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, going after Minnesota's paper mache defense, it'll be nice for them to actually play a real one. But I'm with you. I think it's Houston in five. It sucks. I feel like if Utah, if you flip the opponents, Utah, Golden State, and New Orleans, Houston, I think both series would be more competitive. But I think both higher seeds have some major mismatches advantages here that are gonna punish the lower seeds. So yeah, I'm taking five here as well, and we're gonna get the Western Conference Finals we have been expecting since basically October. So that's at least worth celebrating. All right, Mort, before we sign off, we have a couple health updates on some of the guys we just mentioned in the Rockets Jazz series. Let's start with Ricky Rubio. ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski reported he is likely to be out for 10 days with the hamstring injury he suffered in Game 6 against the Thunder. He said he could be back sooner based on how the rehab goes, but the Jazz are tentatively bracing to be without him for at least the next week. He has already been officially ruled out of Game 1, but as we suspected, Game 2 is also probably a no-go, and then it's looking like even Games 3 and 4 are in jeopardy. So what we just said, without Rubio in Games 1 and 2, this is already looking bad for the Jazz. Does it alter your prediction? You already had them as a sweep, didn't you?
Yeah, well, maybe five games. I want to give them five games. I'm just saying that a sweep could be a real possibility if Rubio misses the first couple of games.
Yeah.
So that just doesn't change anything, unfortunately. Here's hoping that Donovan Mitchell just goes supernova instead.
Right, he's going to have to, because Luke Mbamute, who we also mentioned, he's been upgraded from doubtful to questionable for Game 1. So it sounds like even if he doesn't come back for Game 1...
The rich get richer.
Yeah, he's going to be back in the series, presumably earlier than Ricky Rubio. So like you, Mort, I'm probably still going to stick with Houston in 5. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I don't think his series goes any more than 5. And a sweep is at least in the realm of possibility now, which sucks for Utah.
Right. So we're going to get the two best teams in the Western Conference Finals, as we predicted. And that's obviously going to be the real NBA Finals, honestly.
You're probably right. unless LeBron James turns Super Saiyan and just gets the rest of his team to wake up. But yeah, it's...
Well, he has, and the team is playing in a Game 7, so that doesn't really bode well.
No, it does not. So yeah, we will touch on the East. We'll have a Eastern Conference semifinals preview Monday. We just obviously have to wait until Boston-Milwaukee Game 7 and Cleveland-Indiana Game 7 are done. And then we will have a bye Felicia for the East. Later in the week, we'll have the bye Felicia in the West tomorrow. So check out our Twitter feed at the NBA Pod. You can keep up to date with all of our new episodes there. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some reviews, and love any feedback. And you if you subscribe, you'll get all of our new episodes delivered right to you when they go up. And then we're being hosted on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, so please check them out on Twitter at Almighty Casts. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. I look forward to talking to you in about 5 minutes.
Sounds good.